Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello to you all and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, access to a life-saving intranasal naloxone program could end soon in New Brunswick. Community workers worry that the life-saving measure could be harder to get.
So I now currently have around 400 kits in my house because they'll just... It is of the utmost importance. One reason being that if you don't use, you know, substances, if you don't use opioids, but you carry a kit, you become a safe person.
The Cortis Island Food Bank off the BC coast released its annual report, showing a 600% increase in need for food.
When you realize that there's this much need on the island, then we haven't really got the resources to deal with it in a sustainable way for years and years without getting anybody paid for doing their work. So that was one of the things that's really clear, that we've got a big need.
In Kitchener, Ontario, the Irish Real Life Festival has some alternative ways to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. In a city where drunken St. Patrick's Day parties have become too common in recent years.
If my culture was only celebrated a certain way, which is basically all sort of think going out and having lots of drinks is Irish culture, then I would be upset at that representation. So this is kind of our response to it. We're like, well, nobody else seems to be putting anything else on. Let's see what we can do.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. It would not be the same without you. We'll travel from one end of the country to the other today and start things off in the Maritimes, where access to a life-saving intranasal naloxone program could end soon in New Brunswick. Community workers worry that the life-saving medication could be harder to get their hands on. Naloxone is an important tool because it can reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. Ashley Legere gives intranasal naloxone kits and training to people throughout the community. She's the executive director of the first permanent emergency shelter, Cumberland Homelessness and Housing Support Association in Amherst, Nova Scotia, where she leads a team providing shelter options and meals to about 45 individuals. But she's also involved in harm reduction initiatives across the Maritimes, including New Brunswick. She offers training and free intranasal naloxone kits to groups, businesses, and anyone else interested in knowing how to administer this life-saving treatment. However, her access to free kits is ending on March 31st with no extension in sight. Health Canada's Substance Abuse and Addictions Program has been providing funds to St. John's Ambulance to run the Reaching Home Program that provides training and intranasal naloxone to Legere. Journalist Tori Weldon spoke to Ashley Legere in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Ashley Legere knows these small red naloxone kits inside and out. She's the executive director of the Cumberland Homelessness and Housing Support Association, and she also trains people on how to use these naloxone kits.
I've provided Duckies with kits, the post office with kits. I've trained food bank with kits. I've trained a significant amount of number of people and service providers in Amherst as well as Moncton.
Legere received the training from St. John Ambulance and is the only trained trainer in Sackville or Amherst. These kits are important, and they can and often do save lives.
And Narcan reverses the opioid overdose in your brain. So if you think of your opioid receptors as egg cups, and the opioids are the eggs, and Narcan goes in and kicks those opioids out and sits in your opioid receptors, and it allows you to breathe. Because opioids are respiratory depressants, the opioids in your system are depressing your respiratory system, and Narcan just goes in and enables you to breathe again.
There are two widely available types of naloxone kits. One is intramuscular and is given with a needle. The other is intranasal. And according to Legere, it's easier to use, especially for people who aren't used to working with syringes.
The intranasal kit is just two nasal sprays that you put in the sinus cavity and and give it. So it is much lower barrier. People are more willing to take the training and carry it. People are more willing to then pass that training on or recommend the training to other people.
At the end of Legere's training session, she gives participants 2 free intranasal naloxone kits to take with them. They, like Legere's training, are supplied by St. John Ambulance, but the program's funding could be ending soon.
My name is Alana Ballant. My pronouns are she, her. I'm in Hamilton, Ontario, and I'm the program manager for the Reaching Home stream of St. John Ambulance's National Opioid Program. So our Reaching Home stream is the one that focuses supports to frontline workers, nonprofit workers, poverty relief workers who are supporting people in sort of the overlap of the housing and the toxic drug crisis at this time. So in our program for New Brunswick, we've trained 3,600 folks in responding to opioid poisonings, and we've distributed over 7,000 kits in the community during our approximately 4 years of operations.
The money for this program comes from Health Canada, and it runs out March 31st of this year. St. John Ambulance has applied to continue the program. So far, there's been no indication that more money is on the way. We reached out to Health Canada, and it responded that 700 proposals for funding are being considered. Since 2017, it says it's invested over $565 million and provided support to nearly 390 community-based projects focused on a range of substance use issues. Through the Department of Health, the province distributes naloxone kits free of charge to, quote, people who are at risk of overdose, to family and friends, and to anyone who is most likely to witness and respond to an opioid overdose, end quote. Now, the province says it's supplied about 8,900 take-home naloxone kits since October of 2018. But without St. John Ambulance providing naloxone as well, there could be fewer kits in the community. The Department of Health says it's aware that the program is potentially ending and that it's working with St. John Ambulance to, quote, understand the potential gaps in services for New Brunswickers that may result from the end of federal funding and to identify ways to address them, end quote. And the opioid crisis is here. It's in this province. It's in this area. The Department of Health says in the first half of 2023, there were 23 opioid-related deaths in this province, though it notes the data is still under review and is subject to change. Through her work, Ashley Legere knows people who have died.
We've had multiple deaths in Sackville. We've had multiple deaths in Amherst from the toxic drug supply and the toxic drug poisoning.
So she's stocking up on naloxone kits to distribute before the program potentially wraps up.
So I now currently have around 400 kits in my house because they'll just... They had 300 last month, they gave me 150 this month, and then they'll give, I think, whatever is left, they'll distribute amongst service providers.
Legere will continue to give trainings and disperse these kits in the community as long as she has access to them.
People who use substances reverse more opioid poisonings than paramedics do. So if you can get these out in the community, you are relieving some of the burden of healthcare. So people are being revived and staying alive at home. It is of the utmost importance. One reason being that if you don't use, you know, substances, if you don't use opioids, but you carry a kit, you've become a safe person. I put mine on my, I have a Herschel backpack and I carry it there, and it's bright red. It has a great big cross on it that says naloxone. So it's very visible. It reduces stigma. Like, I carry an Arcan kit with me all the time, and not just because of the job I do, but because when I walk around my community, I want someone to, who I may never know or never know their name, feel like there's people who love them and care about whether or not they live or die.
Anyone interested in receiving nasal naloxone training and the kits that come with it can contact Ashley Legere at sackvilleharmreduction@gmail.com.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang.
So before making our way to the West Coast, we'll drop by Ontario, where the 8-day Irish Real Life Festival kicked off last weekend, a week ahead of St. Patrick's Day, which is coming up on March 17th. The organizers of the Irish Real Life Festival in Kitchener want to put on a different show. They want to move beyond the usual narrative of beer drinking and dig into a deeper understanding of what Irish culture is all about. The 8-day festival festival is in its ninth year. It celebrates all elements of Irish culture and not just those which, in 2019, led to a party that at its peak saw 33,000 students converge on Ezra Street in Waterloo. Organizers of the Irish Real Life Festival spoke about how they are working to expand people's understanding of the Irish story by showcasing another side of Irish culture, such as Irish storytelling, spirituality, and history. Journalist MP Holmes spoke to Sue Naley, the director of the Irish Real Life Festival.
I'm of Irish heritage. My parents immigrated here, and we were looking for something to do around St. Patrick's Day that had some real sort of cultural interest or significance. And, you know, like, there's so many great Irish films, there's great Irish theater, there's music, there's so many things to celebrate. And there was nothing going on other than sort of pub nights, right? And love a good pub night, but we were looking for something else, a little broader sort of, you know, representation. And after that, we were talking to a friend of ours, and she was like, you know, yeah, there really isn't much here. And if my culture was only celebrated a certain way, which is basically all sort of think going out and having lots of drinks is Irish culture, then I would be upset at that representation. I was like, oh, that's interesting, because we just sort of ignore that part as Irish people. We're like, okay, a lot of Irish people in the community don't actually go out on St. Patrick's Day because it's just not a great representation. So this is kind of our response to it. We're like, well, nobody else seems to be putting anything else on. Let's see what we can do. So we started partnering with businesses, with theater companies, with musicians, and all kinds of different people, and had so much interest. People were like, this is great. Like, this is something that we want to help with. And it sort of grew out of there. It was partly a response to, you know, a lot of the shenanigans that happened around that time of year. And people were really happy to have something genuine, something that showcased a better side of things.
According to the CBC, on St. Patrick's Day in 2018, an estimated 22,000 people jammed into the Ezra Street neighborhood near Wilfrid Laurier University. In 2019, the CBC reported that number swelled to 33,000, most of whom were students. The strain on the police, emergency services, and local authorities was significant, and in 2018, the costs for this one day reached over $700,000. Both regional and city councillors have been vocal in their displeasure, and armed with a city report full of recommendations, the City of Waterloo has set out to reduce numbers. But the thing that really reduced numbers in 2020 and 2021 was COVID. In 2022, the revelers were numbered at about 4,000, and last year, that number doubled to 8,000. The Waterloo Regional Police did not respond to CKMS News about what their plans are this year regarding St. Patrick's Day celebrations, but that is consistent with previous years where they've remained tight-lipped before the actual day. The relationship between heavy drinking, the Irish community, and St. Patrick's Day in particular has a dark history. Nally explains the struggle of balancing the drinking culture, the joy of seeing a wide variety of people who want to identify as Irish, and celebrating the culture in other ways.
None of us are against having a good time. You know, that is very much part of Irish culture, is being together and celebrating. And, you know, that is an important part of who we are. But yeah, it's tricky because we don't want to be heavy about why drinking is sometimes an issue. We don't mind people having a good spring fling. We all need it, you know, once the winter is over. But it's just important to note that there's a long history there for Ireland, and there's reasons why the people responded with alcohol. So our aim is to say, okay, yeah, that is part of who we are, for sure. And green was illegal, wearing a shamrock was illegal for many years in Ireland. So seeing thousands of people wear green and wear shamrocks, there is something heartening in that. The fact that people want to sort of identify in a way as Irish, that's beautiful. Yeah. But let's not forget that there's sides, talk about our stories and our you know, our people and our history in different ways, and show them more respectfully.
Some of the festival events highlight the similarities between the Irish community and the Indigenous community, focusing on shared experiences and similarities rather than shared trauma.
So one of the things that we try to do is also acknowledge that we're people who have come here, the diaspora, and we want to live, you know, as good neighbors, and so we try to do some events where it connects with the indigenous population locally. So this year our theme is storytelling. So we're having some indigenous storytellers with doing a storytelling circle with these two Irish storytellers who are coming over from Dublin, and finding those commonalities in our stories. And it's beautiful. We don't want to always focus on the commonalities of trauma. We want to celebrate where we come together in other ways as well. So that's always been important to us.
In addition to celebrating cultural similarities, the festival program presents Irish culture through both a historical and a contemporary lens.
And we try not to be too, we try to balance out like the heaviness of the history with who Ireland is now and the beautiful parts of it. So we are doing a talk on the walls, the mural art of Northern Ireland, with a professor from Grable who did his master's in that, all about the conflict up there and how that shows in the street art. So that's going to be at the registry on Wednesday the 13th. That's going to be really interesting, and a short documentary showing some of the murals. Mm-hmm. And then we're also doing a storytelling night with these two storytellers that we've brought over from Ireland. We have music, we have some family events where kids can see different sides, like dancing, or some of the great kids movies like The Secret of Kells. Mm-hmm. What else do we have? We're doing one on Celtic spirituality, is something that's of big interest to people. I'm exploring that. And some fun things like a trivia night or an Irish sing-along with ukuleles. So we just try to have a bunch of different things that are going to appeal in all kinds of ways.
The event, The Walls Tell a Story, is at the Registry Theatre, and it explores the murals of Northern Ireland, which have become symbols of Northern Ireland, depicting the region's past and present political and religious divisions. Given Ireland's recent experience with war, Nelly commented on how exhibits such as The Walls Tell a Story can help promote peace in areas including Palestine.
As a people, I mean, there is a big connection with the struggles of the Palestinian people and struggles globally with other people whose cultures and identity and place, you know, in their lands are being threatened. So there's a great connection there and a great empathy for what's going on. The reasons for why we do what the festival does is about continuing that path of peace and rediscovering and reconnecting people to the culture and being proud of the culture, because there's a lot of shame in a post-colonial or a post, you know, if you've been in an oppressive history. So that's our mission. But we have been talking about, we want to do something that acknowledges globally these stories. And we're looking at working with groups from a few different cultures who've experienced these things to acknowledge the struggles, but then to, like, what is the path forward? So, like, Ireland is, you know, a century-ish ahead of, on a path from a situation similar in ways to that. So what have we learned? Where can we go? How can we support other peoples going through this?
I'm MP Holmes. Thanks for listening.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to Viewpoints.
The Cortes Island Food Bank released its annual report showing a 600% increase in need for food. The Cortes Island Food Bank is now serving around 80 clients a month on Cortes Island. Now, that may not seem like much, but Cortes Island, located some 150 kilometers north of Vancouver, is home to only 1,000 residents. Some 3,000 tourists visit the island each day during the summer months. So 80 clients, that's a 616% increase year over year, according to the report. It was quite scary because we weren't expecting that big of a rise, says Felipe Figueira, coordinator and treasurer of the Cortes Island Food Bank, speaking to Louis Belcourt.
We wanted to put together an annual report really to tell our members what we've been up to, what our challenges have been, and how the food bank operates, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about certainly the size of the operation that we've got and how big it's got, and then how much resources we've got to deal with it. And then also to paint a picture of where we wanted to take the food bank, really.
So what did you learn from putting all this information together, all the data that you've collected throughout the year? And what did anything spring out when you really put it all out in front of you?
Yeah, well, the main thing is really the rise in clients. And we've been collecting data more and more accurately over the years. And I think it's the third year that we've been collecting data. And one of our main tasks this year was just to really figure out how many clients are really out there if we stepped up and got into a position where we could really offer a good service, because we were getting a low level in the summer months and it never really rose that much. And I think it's amazing. People still didn't know that there was a food bank on Cortez. That was one of the things that was the main focus in last year, certainly, creating a website, making sure that people could email us easily and contact us through the website, that they understood what we could offer. And then we also created a virtual phone number and got it listed in the phone book and on Google so that people could easily find us and just ask for help. And we started all that off in basically August. We really ramped up promoting the food bank. And immediately we got a real response of so many more people. And now, and it was quite scary because we weren't expecting that big a rise. It was also heading into the winter months when everybody's, you know, really suffering and there's not so much seasonal work. And also inflation just went through the roof. And I think even though our government stats say that it's declining, I think everybody is experiencing going to the stores and being shocked by what they're buying and how much it costs and for basic groceries. So I think we just hit that peak. And then I think that's also been something that's been happening nationally. I mean, all food banks across Canada are seeing this huge rise in client numbers. So that was interesting, but we wanted to document what exactly we were seeing. And it's important to put that down in a report so that we can tell the community, but we can also tell local government agencies and funders and grants what we're seeing. And we've got data to prove it, that we've got a big problem on our hands here. So, yeah.
What would you say was some of your biggest challenges throughout the past year, managing the food bank and managing this sharp increase of requests for food?
Right. Basically, we were in a position where we really geared up to source food. We didn't want to ramp up advertising the food bank without having food to be able to supply to people. And then we also ramped up the number of places where people could get food. So we made sure people could get food at the Gorge once a week, or once every 2 weeks, sorry. And then alternate weeks, they could pick up stuff at the Manson's, because a lot of our clients don't have transport and that kind of thing. But it's a lot of work. It's pretty well a full-time job. And we've got some great people working for the food bank, but it's really demanding. So that's one of the challenges. When you realize that there's this much need on the island, then we haven't really got the resources to deal with it in a sustainable way for years and years without getting anybody paid for doing their work. So that was one of the things that's really clear, that we've got a big need. Mm. Food is tricky to source or to budget for, because if we have huge client numbers, then we need a lot more money to be able to feed them. And we just need more money, basically, to provide this service on the island.
And so moving forward into 2024, where I was looking at the report and there's been a continual increase in the request for food. Do you have any strategies moving forward or any particular priorities that you want to focus on to try to keep providing this great service?
I think we did a lot of grant applications and we were really successful in a lot of them. So some of them are from Food Banks BC to help us try and build a more sustainable food bank. But that is, it's money that's not allocated for food. And then we also got some really good money from United Way for a lot of food infrastructure, which is like fridges, freezers, shelving, bringing our storage facilities up to standard. But again, that's not for food. And we've done some good fundraising as well, and people have been very generous on the island. But we're going to be short of money for food. So we need to keep doing that. The other priorities were really, so we're trying to build a more sustainable organization. And part of that is getting more people involved who can contribute to some of the jobs that we need doing, because it's basically come down to very few people doing all the work. So we need to make it, broaden that out a little bit. And that we've trained some fantastic people, and we're really very careful about how we train people, so they really understand the confidentiality issues and understand some of the common misconceptions that people have about food bank users.
What are some of the common misunderstandings of the food bank service in general and food bank users?
I think historically there's always been, the poor have always been somewhat blamed for the situation they're in, right? And the assumption that I hear a lot, unfortunately, from people in the community sometimes, that they feel that people are taking advantage of the food bank, which is really unfortunate that people think that, because the clients we see are people who are basically you and me. They're just people who are struggling to make ends meet through no fault of their own, and they've been put in this situation where everything has become so much more expensive. And it just takes a little thing to push them over the edge, right? You have a medical crisis, you lose your job, you have a sort of financial hiccup that means that you can't get money for a month or something, and suddenly you can't make ends meet. You have to pay all these bills, you have to pay increased housing costs, increased energy costs, heating costs, and we've also got an economy where most jobs are seasonal, right? So if you don't earn enough in the summer to see you through the winter, then you're going to be struggling. And yeah, and I think we just, long term, a community our size should really have a proper food bank facility. It's really costly for us to have no proper food bank, because we have to truck all the food to the community halls. So every couple of weeks, we have to take all the boxes to the gorge and wait for clients. And we have to make sure we have enough there for all the clients that are going to turn up. And the same thing with the hall, Manson's Hall. So it's really time consuming and costly and labor intensive to do that. And if we had a proper building that could maybe be shared with other food security initiatives, then it would make life a lot easier. And I think it'd be much more supportive of the community as well. So that's a plan. We need to find land. We need to find funding. But it's not impossible. I think we could probably, we're working on that over a 3-year period. We're going to try and set something up where we can do that, hopefully.
If someone listening is inspired to help you guys out, what can someone do to contribute?
Financial support is always the best thing. We can make that money go so far. We can buy in bulk, and we're getting about 80 clients a month, or 80 client visits a month. And if you think each client is getting a box, and each box costs anything from $75 to $100 for 2 weeks, which is not excessive, obviously. If you total that up for the year, it's a lot of money. We've calculated that if we get 100 clients a month, then it's $120,000 for the year, which is obviously money we don't have. So money is the biggest thing. People can continue contributing food if possible, but with that volume of people, there's not enough food that gets donated, unfortunately, for us to be able to use it to feed a large amount of people. So yeah, we've got a website, cortezfoodbank.ca, and there's information there about how you can donate, and there's a few options there.
Thank you so much for your time and all your work, Philippe.
No problem. Pleasure.
Louis Beaucourt, Cortez Island.
And And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Our reporters were MP Holmes, Louis Belcourt, and Tori Weldon. Thanks to our national editors, Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to write. We love to hear from you. Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. That's it for this week, and until the next, ciao.